Welcome back to Bubble Trouble, conversations between, well, we're not deep fakes masquerading as humans, Will. We are that real-life double act of the independent analyst Richard Kramer, that's me, and the economist and author Will Page, that's him. We're closing in fast on our 100th episode of exposing the sycophants and stenographers who create the bubbles and get our portfolios into trouble. And as we always like to say, if there's a bubble that burst, we usually are the ones that pricked it first. We're going to tap into this topic that we haven't really spent a lot of time with to date, the excitement around the big cloud service providers like Microsoft, Google, and of course the market leader Amazon's AWS. Are we getting ahead of our skis about what's another form of storage or a place to compute stuff? Or is this truly a game-changing transformation for organizations that changes everything that they do? We're joined by a true expert, Liam Maxwell, who's understood IT from inside government, which is a very hard thing to understand to begin with. It's how governments function. And from outside as a senior person at AWS. We're going to travel from the clouds above Amazon headquarters in Seattle to rather different clouds above the Ukraine, where Liam played a pivotal role in securing their government's data and future. More in a moment.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Well, we're blessed by tech giants today in that we're here at the world-class studios of Platoon, an Apple-owned company, and we're joined by a key part of the Amazon machine, AWS. And Liam, to bring you to the microphone and let you introduce yourself, we usually ask for a tweet-like introduction, which puts a limit on the amount of words, but your career is so incredible. We'll come to the Ukraine in a second. But more importantly, why on earth did you go into Whitehall government offices with a suitcase full of fake banknotes?
Thanks, Will. That's a really nice introduction. So I'm a technologist. I worked as a CTO in business and then was a teacher. And then I started to get involved in local politics and got elected, and we put together what was the test lab for David Cameron's opposition at the time. And then when they came into government, I was asked to come and join the government and as an official, and I joined and became the CTO for the British government. And really working with a brilliant team there, we put together changes to the way that the citizen interacts with the state, a fantastic team led by Tom Lewis-Moore and Mike Bracken doing that. But also the underpinnings of that, what that was running on, and giving government the ability to be flexible and move off 25 years of building technology in a particular way so that they could be flexible, so that they could get more secure, and they could also build brilliant services for much, much less money. And so that combination of being able to operate at scale, operate at speed, but and with security, but also make savings was brilliant way of helping that move. And it was really good fun doing that within the government. And yeah, we had some ways of explaining that, which were controversial, but we did actually build a team which was copied or imitated worldwide. And Amazon came to me in 2018 and said, look, we'd really like you to help customers, our government leaders accelerate their modernization and transformation programs. And they've given me the ability to go and do that. And that's what I do now for a living is help operational leaders in governments accelerate their modernization programs.
I want to give a shout out to Mike Bracken quickly, because he had this brilliantly simple idea, which was, why don't we make all the government websites built on the same template so that they all look the same? And when you navigate them, they all feel the same.
Oh, yeah.
And it was not only a tremendous cost savings, but the benefit when you go onto multiple websites from the government and they all basically have the same app and the same look and feel. So, it's just such a blue flame, simple idea. And it's not radical at all. It got rid of dozens of projects of Frankenstein code.
Well, Richard Pope and Ben Terrett were two guys who were within that space. Actually, the conversation was around was, you as a citizen, why do you need to know where family tax credits is and which website you need to go to? There's the government. Right. And the only time actually people want to know which bit of the government is delivering their thing is when they want to make a complaint. Right. When they want to go to government, they just want to go, I want to go to the government to find out what the thing is and how it works. And it should be simple for people. But it also, a brilliantly simple idea, it did mean there was a lot of cost savings. So for one example, there were 125 million telephone calls coming into the government every year. And each call was it's 12 or 15 pounds. I mean, it's a lot of money spent, but a quarter of those calls were saying, where is this on the website?
Deadly
so if you can
loss.
Make the website clearer, you save a lot of people's time, a lot of people's energy. And the thing is, you can focus the taxpayers' money on building brilliant services and delivering frontline services, which ultimately is why people have a government.
I love it. I love it. It's pioneering. And to your credit, it's been copied by many other countries since. So just to stress the quality of a guest we have, this is something which has gone global. But I can't let you off the hook. Give the people having dinner parties this weekend a story to tell about that suitcase of fake money.
So it wasn't actually fake money, but we would go to a meeting with members of people who were trying to build systems, and they would explain quite how much it was going to cost. And sometimes the numbers were really eye-watering. And so one day I remember just having a bag and just going, look, let's work out what does that actually look like? If you're going to spend £60 million to build a particular thing, let's actually see how £60 million looks like. And can we use that to help identify how, that it's smaller. In fact, in that case, we got it down to 12.
Wow.
Just by putting it on the table in front of people. So sometimes stunts work, sometimes they don't. But it was paper the size of banknotes that it was white paper the size of banknotes.
So you'll be cancelled by the Forestry Commission?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay, right. Now, the key to a great podcast is to assume no prior knowledge for our audience's benefit. Let's get everyone on the same 20-yard line. This conversation is going to go deep, but let's stay shallow for the moment and put a definition on what its cloud is. Imagine a company, an institution, and it has to store lots of stuff. And that stuff is stored in perhaps local data centers. And then that company says, hold on, there's this thing called a cloud. I'm going to shove that stuff up there. What actually happens on the technical back end? And what does the frontline office worker actually see as a result?
So, and it's the big thing about cloud is it's really not just all about storage, but so think about it just in that storage case, it's much simpler. If everyone's doing the same thing and commonly storing data on their local systems, you've got to do the backups, you've got to do the resilience, it's got to fail over to places. Every single company would be doing exactly the same thing. So what cloud does is it gives you the opportunity to have capabilities as a service. Wow. So that you can get a storage capability or a compute capability or a database capability. And you don't have to go and buy the servers, set up the servers, put them in a nice room, all of that stuff. It's all there for you. And so one of the ways we describe it is we do the sort of undifferentiated heavy lifting of IT so that all of the basics can be done by the cloud provider. And then the business can turn up and instead of spending huge amounts of time maintaining the infrastructure and making everything work, they can get on with the brilliant stuff of designing fantastic apps that really work for their users, and they can spend all of their time and all of their money on that, and the infrastructure part of it, or the databases, or the compute, or the AI, or all of those things are all building blocks on which they've built this.
So you're beautifully illustrating for me the productivity gain. Like just at street level, I could spend 80% of my time worrying about back-end infrastructure and 20% scaling my business. You want me to spend 100% of my time scaling my business, and AWS takes care of the back-end infrastructure.
That's right.
Perfect.
That's right.
Second question is, we kind of got a visualization here of what the cloud is. How do you pay for it?
It's pay as you go. So you pay for the services that you use. and when you use them. And some of our billing is second, sub-second billing because you're only using things for very, sometimes you're only using
There's
things
no
for very short periods
at
of time.
It's none of these like nope. onerous IT contracts where you're paying for stuff you don't need.
Because, yeah, no, none of that. Because you don't need to pay CapEx. You don't need to pay capital expenditure. You go and you rent the services that you need when you need
them. I want to come back to two dreadful letters you put together previously, which was IT. Now, when you and I started out here, IT, two or three, four decades ago, IT was pure nerd porn, right? It was pocket protectors, thick glasses, and body odor, right? It was that yeah. the guys in the compute lab at the university who
and
were programming in COBOL or Fortran or what have you, or BASIC. And then it became a sexy thing for tech bros. But one constant to my mind in this IT world has been the software companies promising that the next piece of software, the next release of software, would solve all your problems. How is it that when our listeners think about the frustrations they've had with software generally, with IT generally, how do they guard against the fact that the software industry has forever been creating these bubbles of promiseware, of vaporware, of the next version will take care of all of our problems? And we've all had these regular frustrations. Is the cloud going to take that away, or is this just a feature of the tech market that we are, as you might say if you're a West Ham supporter, forever blowing bubble?
Perhaps could I explain, because we don't think of it that way.
Okay.
And perhaps if I could just explain the way that we sort of think about innovation is that the innovation that we work with is we work with our customers on their innovation to help produce the components that we do. So about 90% of the innovations that come through AWS are things which our customers have come to us and said, look, I've got this problem and it's a common problem. Can you help us build it? And so that's where we get to be able to build things because we work backwards from the problems with our customers to try and help build things. The other side of that is that we then are always in a position where we make an announcement that it's something we've worked on, we've built, we've put together, it's working, the customer's happy with it, we get to that stage, and then we make an announcement about it and say, look, this thing, it's a common component, it's a common capability which you can have as a service. This customer already using it, you can now have it too. And that approach means it would answer your particular complaint to that, but that's actually part of the way that we always think is that if you can work backwards from the customer, work backwards from the user, that builds.
And those customers don't mind sharing their clever ideas with someone else?
We find because these are common core components that people have and yes, with customers. But can I also just say one of the big things that we do with governments is that governments don't compete.
Right.
I mean, I work in the government space.
Right.
And governments don't compete. Right. The driving service in Norway don't have a driving license office in Sweden.
Right.
Because they don't need to.
Right.
And yet they do exactly the same thing. And so quite a lot of the work that I do is about helping governments identify that someone else is already doing something like that and that moves.
And going back to
Will's story about Ben Terrett and Richard Pope's, you know, GovUK, the website of the government of New Zealand looks quite a lot like the website of the British government's website. Do you know why? Because it is. Because
right.
they open sourced it.
Right. Just very quickly
brilliant
there,
people.
When you describe the innovation happening with AWS and off AWS, can you just give a crystal clear case study example of a company or an institution that went to you saying, I want to store all this stuff, and 6 months, 12 months later said, now I want to do all this stuff, the transition between storing and innovating?
Yeah, I mean, and storage is one of the first services is to get storing. So there's a restaurant delivery group that I remember advising in the States, and they wanted to come to us with an idea around they wanted to deliver things, but they kept on trying to deliver things, and they had to use a map, and they had to pay for the map, and sometimes the map in a particular market was this map, and it worked better, and sometimes it was in another, and they had to continually cut the changes to make that work. So there was an example there where the team that was working with them built a geolocation service, which meant that you could choose which map you were going to use to help yourself move forward.
Wow.
That's one example.
Better maps, better delivery, better demand, better
yeah,
store.
But also if you start thinking around the ability to have a moving actually from massive storage to being able to get a landing zone or a service, it was called a service workbench, which was just a starter kit that lots of universities had come to us to say, look, we store all this stuff with you, but we want to be able to move faster by having all the things we do at the beginning of a project. Let's just speed that up. And so you can get the templatizing, the work that you know, the routines you have, because you've done it all before. So why start from scratch, spin the thing up, just have a kit to get yourself going.
Making academics more efficient?
Yeah.
You should deserve the Nobel Prize.
Although he did just use the word templatizing, which I think most other guests, we would pretty much show them the door at this stage.
Yeah.
But now I'd like to come back to, again, this sort of culture of IT, because I was told long ago, three things you cannot tell a man how to do. One is drive a car. Two is make love to his or her partner, however you want to say that. Or three is buy tech hardware, right? And you have these IT directors or CIOs for years would love to go and pat their mainframe computers or their servers, close the door, turn out the lights, and have this big smile on their face. And we've seen these cycles in the industry of going from distributed computing to centralized computing to distributed computing and centralized. And I guess my question is, when a CIO who sees all their peers going to the cloud, what is going to stop them or what doesn't encourage them to say, I'm going to be different because I'm going to have my own stuff. And I want to have my own stuff and build it my own way. And we see some of the biggest companies do that because they're sophisticated. But how do we know this isn't a pendulum that will swing back the other way when computing gets cheap and personal enough that we don't necessarily need to have the same solution as everybody else?
Richard, just to preempt Liam's answer here, you're reminding me of the famous James Barksdale quote, which is, ladies and gentlemen, the future of business is either bundling or unbundling.
Yeah.
I think, And you have seen that the pendulum swing backwards and forwards as you went from mainframe to client server to centralized, you know, in and out. And you have seen a lot of that. I think that the reason was, I think the pendulum is going to swing and stay swung one way for a long period of time is AI. But can I just go back as to why we think that? So cloud is not just storage. It's the ability to access hundreds of capabilities of, we have services. We've got a really broad and deep range of services which we offer. And those services are available on a pay-as-you-go basis. So you pay for what you use. And that means that the flexibility for the way people pay for the services that they consume becomes very much it's you're only paying for what you use. So the leakage isn't there. The wastage isn't there. It's much more thrifty to do it that way. It also means that you can scale, that you can actually move things very, very quickly. So if you're running your own data center and your own things, you then go, actually, we now want to move into the European market and we want to start building more stuff in Germany. We want to get this, you're doing movies and you want to get close to your customer and you want to deliver those things or some engineering routines. That, you have to go and build a whole new set of things in Germany. Well, actually, within the cloud model that we have, you can go and deploy your services there. You can expand easily using the same code, the same materials, same structures into those areas. So that helps you scale really well.
You can hit the ground running.
Yeah. The speed means that you can do that relatively quickly. But the other really big component is the security. I mean, if I give you the example, I inherited a government estate when I started as CTO that was, I mean, there's a brilliant guy called James Duncan working with me, and we tried to work out where's all the servers. And we worked out, we had something like 350 data centers around the country, which were running government tech. And I had no way of checking that everything was patched. I mean, let alone whether the security guards' dogs were being fed properly so that they would be out there at night protecting it. So none of those things that are around the core infrastructure were recorded in place. And so my security posture, I just improved it almost instantly by moving to the cloud, where you know the security is the same level of security as the most demanding customers. And moving that helped us increase the security posture whilst, I'll say this again, whilst the cost for doing it reduced markedly. So it was a really big change. So speed, scale, and security mean that's why you swing into the cloud. Why does it stay there? As if you're offering the ability, and what we're sort of doing is democratizing access to brilliant services, because a small company or a large government or a large company can access these cloud services on exactly the same terms. You're then able to offer people capabilities that they'd never been able to build before because they can do it as a service. And so people can have access to foundation models and the huge amounts of data that you need in order to put together a really effective and efficient AI on a credit card. And if you do that the old traditional way, that's billions of pounds of investment and billions and lots of years and lots of people putting it together. Whereas cloud actually gives you the ability to access AI on a credit card. And that's why, I mean, I've got a sticker on the back of my phone that is no cloud, no AI. I mean, it's you need it in order to do it. And so whilst that continues, that's going to be in place, I can see, for the foreseeable.
Now, you've mentioned the importance of the ability to move fast, to hit the ground running, to scale solutions in an incredibly short space of time, a short space of time that's inconceivable in the age of local data storage. And that's in times of peace. So I think we should now, Richard, turn our attention to war. But before you do, Richard, we should just give a quick hat tip to Fergal Sharkey, and we'll link to this in the show notes, whose speech in Have I Got News For You last week pretty much had the entire audience on our standard BBC comedy show in tears, referring to the importance of peace. And with that backdrop, given last time we were in this amazing studio with Fergal Sharkey, we should turn our attention to events in Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, Liam, you had told us coming into this about this incredible story when the Ukraine war began about having to effectively lift and shift, as you would say in the IT world, their entire government and make sure it was backed up somewhere that wasn't likely to be under a bombardment. And while putting all your data in one place does in some cases make it more vulnerable, if that one place is specifically vulnerable, you've got to distribute that data pretty quickly. So do you want us to walk us through what you did with AWS as a government-focused person to help the Ukraine government make sure that it wouldn't lose all that valuable data for running itself whilst it was under attack?
Yeah, so, I mean, very early on, the Ukraine suffered some strikes on their data centers, but they had some luck because they had Ukraine's got a brilliant STEM education system. They've got lots of really brilliant engineers,
absolutely,
lots of fantastic engineering and computer science background. And their digital minister is a guy called Mikhail Fedorov, and he's inspirational and brilliant. And I met him the year before the war. He'd come to London to talk about, and he'd gone to GDS to go and talk to them. And he came and had a chat with me, and we signed a sort of let's get together MOU. And then we realized between then and the beginning of the war, we started having conversations with them about you need to think about continuity of government. It's going to be really important. The president made sure that a bill was passed, which meant that data could be stored outside the country if it needed to be. And we're
talking sensitive data like health records, where there would be a concern if they were stored elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, people should be concerned where their data is stored.
Yes.
Whatever.
Right.
And then on the day of the invasion, by happenstance, I booked in to go and see a guy called Vadim Pastryko, who was the ambassador in London, who actually was a computer scientist by trade. And we sat down and had this strange lunch where, you know, the invasion had just started. And he was serving up this brilliant borscht. And I was sitting there going, so I think we probably need to work out how we can help you. And he said, look, the first thing you've got to do is we've got to make sure we've got continuity. And so I said, well, of what? Let's work it out. What's the most important thing? And he just said, population register. Okay, first thing, population register. Second thing, land register. Mm-hmm. Now, those two, because the population register, the first thing the Russians are going to do when they invade is they're going to go, why don't we have a referendum? Oh, we'll keep the list. And it's the classic Stalin quote, isn't it? It doesn't matter where the votes are, it's who counts them. And if you've got to make sure the list is right. You've got to make sure that the land register is there so the land doesn't get stolen and taken away.
I have to say, those two boxes you had to tick, they just visually bring the horrors of war to life.
Yeah,
like, it makes you rethink when you see tanks on TV, but no, there's something much, much bigger at stake.
It's about the people.
Well, and equally, there is an entire theater of war, which is in the cyber world, which is constant and ongoing.
Yeah.
And in this case, in the Russia-Ukraine case, is ongoing every day. We don't hear about it the way you might hear about bombs and invasions and counter strikes or counter offensives. But this cyber attack mentality is relentless.
And we and lots of other tech companies did huge amounts of work helping the Ukrainians protect. But in terms of the data, so we had the population register, land register, then we wrote down tax register, mm-hmm. Criminal records, healthcare, education, welfare. And in a way, there you go, you've got a state. With those registries, you've got a state. You've got the ability to start to move. And so we
you have
did
a
that.
Country.
So we then said, okay, so we've got to back those bits up. How do we do it? And so I went and got these devices, explained to the ambassador what they were, which is a device called a Snowball. So a Snowball, imagine a 90 terabit USB stick. Okay, it's about the size of a suitcase. And there's edge capability on it for communications, but it's a storage, classic storage device. Okay, so you put it, but you can run
it's
computer
a giant
on it.
Data suitcase.
I've lost USB sticks in pubs before. I'm not going to lose this one.
Well, that's it. So they're about the size of a suitcase, and we took three of those. And a colleague of mine, flew them through Amsterdam onto Krakow, and handed over the Snowballs to a member of the Ukrainian team, who was in a truck. In a people wagon, and they stuck the suitcases in the back, and off they went into Ukraine. And I've got to say, I mean, he said to me at the time, he said, "That's the most nervous I've ever been at a baggage claim, because these things go in the hold of an aircraft. I mean, they're really rugged."
Right.
And so they took the Snowballs, off they went, took the Snowballs, and on the Monday we got these calls coming back in, which were, "I've got this thing, what do I do?" And so we had this brilliant set of, and everyone volunteered in the company, volunteered to do it. And they set up a Ukraine center called Project Sunflower, which we did over that weekend. And the Sunflower team then started helping the Ukrainians boot the devices up, plug them in, make sure the manual worked for them, because each of them, I mean, the manual's a Kindle stuck mm-hmm. to them. And then you...
Brand.
And yeah, but... Simple thing to have, yeah. and then translating the instructions from English into Ukrainian, Ukrainian into English. Thank you, Google Translate. And then they very, very quickly got that moving using encrypted messaging service, and they then started to back up. And at the same time, there were the banks, and there were the universities who were going, "What do we do? How do we save our stuff if we get bombed?" And there's a brilliant guy in one of the banks, Privat Bank, which was it's a bank of about 18 million people in Ukraine, banked with Privat Bank, so very big. And they backed up and migrated completely. And a migration in normal times takes a few months, and it's very, very complex, got going. This guy led his team, this is the customer, 45 days, migrated, I think it's 2,500 servers, 350 applications into the cloud in 45 days, petabytes of data.
And if we rewind that quite simply now, the Ukrainian government can run all of its technology back end without any of it being in Ukraine.
Yes. And some of it still runs some services inside Ukraine. But the really important thing there is that, as any GovTech nerd will go, brilliant, they had the registries. The registries work. But some things are still running. And Misha's been really clear about this in public. He said, look, Dia, which is their super app, which is a brilliant device, means that everyone can use it to report, so to do their welfare benefits, their education. They've even built services now where you can sort of tap in. There's a Russian group around the corner from me here. So it's the citizen app. Dia runs in Ukraine in an undisclosed location or several undisclosed locations. But if it fails, if they get taken out, it fails over onto AWS.
Right.
So that's
somewhere outside of Ukraine.
Somewhere outside Ukraine.
In the rest of the world.
That's right.
Not to narrow it down.
Oh, yeah. No. And, I can't. No, I'll be really honest. I can't narrow it down. I don't know where it is.
Right.
And there's no need for me to know where it is. I know it's in the cloud and it's been looked after properly and it's in the right place.
Well, that is a fascinating and inspirational story of how the cloud might work in under the direst of circumstances, which we don't really want to think about too deeply. You want to?
Yeah, I just want to just reflect on that incredible story. You know, big tech often gets bashed. And I often defend big tech by saying, don't compete on cost, they compete on convenience. Rather than what the textbook says that you do, they expand output. And in the case of the cloud, you've expanded output. And they eliminate costs. In the case of the cloud, it's a lot cheaper than data storage. They also contribute to solving conflict.
Yeah.
Do you feel this Ukraine story needs to be wider told. I mean, it does feel like it's been, it's not a page one story yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if I go to the IMDb website and see Liam Maxwell in production, the Ukraine AWS story.
Well, it won't be me because it's a brilliant, there were 600 people in the team doing it. I mean, a brilliant
600 people.
Load of volunteers all the way across the company who just donated their time to do it.
That's important to hear.
Yeah. And it was. And if I just explain the way of doing it was, as it happened, we have two ways of starting any program, which is you create a, you say, this is the charter, this is the mission we're going to do. And then you set up a set of tenets, which are, this is how we're going to do it. And a brilliant woman, Maggie Carter, who I worked with during COVID when we did a similar thing for a diagnostic development initiative, we sat down that weekend and said, right, here are the tenets. This is the mission. This is what we do. We announced it to the teams across the piece. People picked that up. The mechanisms were in place from her brilliant disaster recovery team. And that meant that you could just get the ministries could say, come to us and say, look, I've got these workloads. How can you do it? Strip straight through. As long as it met the tenants, they could move fast. And that's the weird bit about working in, and when working in Amazon, is that the ability to make a decision is so much quicker than anywhere else I've worked, because we have a real concept of two-way doors. That if a decision is a two-way door, if you can go through it and come back, then if you're 70% sure of where you want to go, take it, take the decision. And that's how we devolve power right down to everybody within the company. And the decision, the way you take that decision is you look at the team you're working on, what are the tenets of the team? 70% certain I'm okay on this, bang, off we go. And that means you can go fast. And that also means that you can really get ahead of big challenges. And that's not just getting ahead of an invasion, but it's getting ahead of a disease as it was traveling around the world.
Well, we need to wrap up part one with Liam Maxwell. I would only say one of the shocking things I pointed out to Will very early on in our Bubble Trouble podcast was that the £22 billion spent by the UK government on their test and trace app, which didn't work, is the equivalent of the entire annual R&D budget of Google that year. And you just wish that you had brought in some competent people to write that app in a weekend, as opposed to allow the UK government to spend months making a hash of it. We'll leave it at that for part one and come back in a moment with more with Liam Maxwell.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome back to part two of Bubble Trouble with the estimable and very experienced Liam Maxwell from AWS, formerly of her or his majesty's government, of IT fame. Will, you wanted to discuss the cloud and GDP.
Yeah, I mean, you've laid out beautifully in part one just how transformative this tech is. And that's not just for the private sector, but the public sector as well. And I'm just, I have this bug in my basement, which is, does the government actually capture what you do? The government captures what agriculture and fisheries do. The government captures what construction does. They look at cranes. The government captures what a car plant does. They produce cars. But I want to explore down a rabbit hole with you. Does it even capture the cloud at all? With three...
Well, it's one of the things where, because cloud delivers a huge amount of productivity, because instead of everybody running and building and raking their own servers and putting their things together and spending time spinning up an AI routine, et cetera, and learning how to do it. It's lots of this stuff. The services are there for you to use on a pay-as-you-go basis. And there was some brilliant work done by some of my colleagues in the UK, which we looked at, which was how much value does the cloud actually bring to government? The thing was that the thing we discovered was that we found the economic value of leveraging cloud was several billion dollars of gross value add to the economy. In my head, I remember it coming out as the same value as the Premier League to the economy. That's just the AWS bit of the cloud.
What you do on top of that, the innovation side, well, that produces gross value added, which is going to be captured elsewhere, yeah, but traces back to the cloud as its instigator.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that I genuinely don't know whether the ONS model or capture this, but the thing is the productivity gains that people can see and the ability to, again, just do things so much quicker.
Yeah.
So go from an idea to a brilliant app where all you need to do is work on the app and not on the infrastructure and the communications, all of that stuff, because you can just get that on a pay-as-you-go basis. That's priceless because, again, if you look around in a competitive market, everyone else is doing that as well. So you need to go that fast.
Well, to go a little bit deeper in this topic, because I think we can uncover something quite crucial here, which is this transformative technology is invisible in government accounts. That's my assertion. I just want to probe it further, which is, let's look at price, let's look at CapEx, and let's look at location. On price, I published some work this week which showed in 2001, you gave $9.99 for Rhapsody, a music streaming service, and you got 15,000 tracks. Today, you give $9.99 and you get 110 million tracks. You're getting a whole lot more for your money.
Mm.
That's hard for government to measure. The unit cost is the same, but the output is so much more different. Without getting too technical here, surely that same dilemma has to exist with cloud. If I spent $100,000 on cloud services, let's say 10 years ago, I would have got X. If I pay you $100,000 today, I get Y.
Well, and also you get a much broader set of services that you were using, because instead of this idea around common infrastructure, which started, I mean, originally with storage, compute, databases, but then built services. So as you went up the tech stack, more and more of the components of the tech stack were becoming available as a common service because the cloud enables you to do that. I mean, even if you think about the capabilities that are open to us to leverage things like Lex and the voice to text translator, transcribe, those sort of AI services, which are now AI services that are just use it as a service, and you can get that from the cloud on a credit card.
And so
it's much more efficient and effective. Coming back to you, though, in the olden days, people would have spent lots of GDP and huge amounts of money building those routines and putting those things together themselves, and somebody three streets down would be doing exactly the same thing, and three streets down they'd be doing exactly the same thing, and now it's just a common service. And so people who want speed, scale and security go, right, well, I'll just go and use a credit card and get it as a service.
And it's not just a contribution to the economy that's getting lost. It could also be inflation. I mean, let's just park up for a second and think about the smartphone. I could have a printer in the CPI inflation basket. I could have a scanner in the CPI inflation basket, and I could have a telephone. Now I've got a smartphone. I don't need those other two items, but they could still be there. And it's the same thing with the cloud in terms of what you're able to achieve with that expenditure is so much more. And it's displacing activity that would have happened elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it means that people are able to invent. In a way, the best thing about this is that it enables people to invent more quickly, more effectively. And also their chances of success are better because they're not investing all that mind share and bandwidth in keeping the infrastructure going.
Quick cash prize Scottish question for you. This is for a Scottish £20 note. How much GVA does a smartphone add to the US economy?
No idea.
A big fat zero, because international accounting means you have to attribute it to Taiwan and South Korea.
Really?
Interesting.
Right. Okay.
Question two is to take economic theory, just real quick here.
Yeah.
The argument goes, you expand capital expenditure and you boost productivity. In part one of this show, you said you're not doing CapEx anymore. You're not having local data servers. You're leasing. That's current expenditure. How does the economic theorist figure this out? Because now I'm reducing capital expenditure, but I'm absolutely smashing productivity through the ceiling.
I'm sort of stuck on the question of what.
I think the ONS are stuck on this question too, okay, because you overturn the rule book.
Yeah, I think it is. It is a new using and leveraging common capabilities is something that we, when we were making things and in the manufacturing industry, it's very difficult to do. But in the technology industry, it's where the speed and the scale is. I suppose the other change is, just to give you a view of how different it is, when I did a startup in 2000 and we had to go and borrow 4 million quid, and we went and bought a load of servers and we built a development network, a test network and a production network. And this was running an online recruitment company, and it was in Holborn, and they were all there, and you had to back up into different places, etc. Now, all of those things, gone. I'll just put on a credit card.
But look, I've got to derail Will's nerd porn about statistics and the ONS right now. But what explains the productivity paradox? The fact that if you look at productivity in many Western societies, it doesn't seem to have moved greatly, even though we've got all these tools available to us. What is holding it back? Because we can see the capabilities which are now at our fingertips. When I came to London 30 years ago, of course everybody had an A to Z. Today it's like a historical artifact. We all have maps on our smartphones. Where is the productivity paradox disappearing into that we don't get to see it in the economic statistics, in GDP growth, in our lives, that we're not showing that productivity?
I want to answer this for you before I hand to my guest with a simple sentence, which is, what matters most to our lives is being measured least by our statisticians. And this is what I'm thrusting at. I just don't think what you're doing to society is being captured by our governments.
Or any government. Because where is there a government around the world that does capture that? And this enormous change. And I suppose part of it is to say that, I mean, I'll be honest and say that my focus isn't on that. My focus is on building and delivering brilliant services to government leaders so that they can go faster to build better public services, so less tax is used in administration and more tax is used in frontline service.
Right.
That's what we do. And we use the cloud to do that, and that's the sort of, those are the numbers that really affect me.
Just to wrap it up and put a pin in it, I think I do have to raise a Victorian concept with you and see whether it resonates in terms of where this whole thing is like a square peg trying to fit inside a round hole, called Jevons' paradox, which is, during the coal era of the Victorian times, Walter Jevons said, "Why is it that when we become more coal efficient, we end up using more coal?" My favorite one, it's not that sexy, is to look at refrigerators. When refrigerators become more energy efficient, what do? We buy even bigger refrigerators. Or if cars become more fuel efficient, we live further away from our offices and we spend more time in our cars. Is there a Jevons paradox thing here which happens with the cloud, which is, as I become more cloud efficient, I use more of the cloud?
I think,
and that just doesn't sit
well. But there is, and there's also another incentive for doing that, because you see, the more that you start using cloud, I mean, if you start using, I can only speak for the numbers of the company I work for, but if you start using cloud, our research is that you use 80% less carbon. You know, that your carbon footprint goes down by 80% if the more you move into the cloud. So there's actually a really good benefit, because you're using much, much less energy. You're pooling it. You're not needing to keep all those data centers cool, all the rest of it, because someone else is doing all that for you in a strong and resilient way. But it also means that you get people use and generate much less electricity. And that means there's much less impact on the environment from IT. I mean, the impact of large numbers of low efficiency data centers, the old model, is quite enormous in terms of just the carbon that they're using up. And so the cloud actually gives you a route to much lower carbon.
And it is astonishing, this relentless march of IT expenditures, broadly defined as a percentage of GDP, which keeps going up and up and up, even when the individual cost or per unit of compute capacity or storage or any of the elements of it keeps going down, down, down. And that is obviously reflecting that tech takes a bigger role in our lives, all the time.
And we have many more tech jobs. I mean, so one of the big things that we, one of the numbers we, when I was in government, I was looking at the digital economy. I actually was responsible for growing the digital economy. It was part of my job spec that my brilliant boss.
Growing something that can't be measured.
Yeah, isn't it?
No, you can't measure. You can't measure.
Isn't it best to stay out of the way if you want to grow the digital economy?
Sorry.
Isn't it best to just stay out of the way?
Well, in many ways, yes, that was part of it. But you can measure it. But the thing, one of the things we also measured and came back with was that the wages of people who worked in the digital economy were about 40% higher than the wages in the rest of the economy.
Mm.
And so there was a definite incentive to start to help people move there because you can get a better paying job. And that meant that's much better for everyone concerned.
And just a quick to put a Christmas bow and tie on this topic of my geekness about statistics. Oh. I want to remind Liam Maxwell and my audience, my favorite example of this, which is when you raise the issue of the environment, carbon emissions, that if you think about Wikipedia, it is the sum of all the world's knowledge, it does no environmental damage, and it adds nothing to gross domestic product. To which Liam Maxwell can think of lots of things which are not the sum of the world's knowledge, do terrible environmental damage, and add lots to gross domestic product. What matters most is being measured least.
Yeah, I mean... undoubtedly, there is a measurement issue with this, the broad march of IT. And I would argue, because we had Cory Doctorow sitting here, who's probably on the other side of you of many things, but a very brilliant critic in many respects, he would argue that a lot of those non-tech jobs have been relentlessly devalued to where we aren't paying enough to people who are working in social care, are cooking our meals, are doing the kind of things that we should be valuing higher, and that gulf is really unfortunate and highly damaging. We don't pay very much at all to the people who stand in front of our children and teach them however many cloud-enabled tools we give them. We're just underpaying these people relative to their value to society, whereas we hugely privilege these tech jobs because the tech industry is brilliant at promoting itself. And in some cases, I would regard the statistic you just gave us as a symptom of a problem, not necessarily something we want to aspire to, because there's a huge range of jobs. And I feel this very, very personally because I have an elderly mother that finding people to care for her when she can't care for herself is very difficult. And those jobs can't be outsourced to tech. They aren't cloud jobs. And we're not paying enough for the people who do those jobs because we've run towards the tech-enabled future. And I don't know how we're going to deal with that in the future as more and more of those jobs aren't finding the simple volume of people willing to do them at the clearing price which we offer to pay.
Okay. So, I mean, I suppose my focus on that, I can't change. Maybe the way the industry goes, et cetera. But I think one of the things I'd say is that it is really important that we can, if I go back to it, help governments and government service delivery focus on delivering the frontline service.
100%.
Not the administration. Yeah. And being able to be flexible to do that is there. So one of the guys I work with a lot is a guy called Mark Thompson, who was a professor at Exeter and Cambridge and Exeter. And he did a brilliant piece in The Guardian, if you look it up, but it's about a Dutch system called Buurtzorg. And what it was that this great, straightforward selection of how you do the get social care selected and who you get and worked. Somebody turned up and just reformed it so that it was the most efficient, most simple, most effective way of doing it. And this monolithic system was put in place to make it work. And actually it made everybody's care much, much worse. And what they were able to do was to take a step back and say, let's go and design a service and a system that's built around the pensioners, the people that were getting the care, who were being given care, and build that and make that work. And the flexibility and the ability to make that requires a lot of different thinking, but these old monolithic IT things were getting in the way.
Yeah.
And Buurtzorg was a way of actually being flexible and bringing that together and delivering more service and frontline service and less administration, and that really is where, if I can do anything in the gig I've got, is that's what we're really focusing on.
Yeah, maybe a philosophical question before we get you to smoke signals, which is I'm flying to Denmark next week to work on this Women in Music Award, and I always admire Denmark as a country, 5 million people, the way they open their shutters in the morning, the way they close them at night. It's a pretty impressive way of running the show. Is there a country, government, market, back end that you admire and hold up as that's what good looks like? That's what we should aspire to do?
Well, good looks like in doing a citizen app, as I explained, was actually Ukraine. Okay, that's really interesting. Also Singapore and SingPass and all of those components. And I'm really lucky because when I joined AWS, they said, go and find the best people in the world to come and work with you. And I worked with a woman called Choi Ping Wu. She was the founding CIO of Singapore. And that's her vision. And it's brilliant that you've seen that come into play. So that's something that I found really interesting. Service New South Wales, just focus on the service and get it across. That's a really good example. And then, of course, the one place which I've always found absolutely spellbinding in how they did it, there's two guys, Pramod Varna and Nandan Nilekani, who put together the Aadhaar program in India, which is beautiful in its simplicity about how it condensed the identity program into just a question of, is Pramod Pramod? Is the person in front of me the person in front of me? 8 pieces of data, 1 12-digit thing, 1.4 billion people signed up to it. Yeah. Absolutely unbelievable. But what
economic and societal progress that unlocks.
But the economic progress there, because then you build the banking stack on top of that, all of those components, and the effect on female economic empowerment in India is now starting to be felt and starting to see. And you look, if you think about where competition is, absolutely amazing place to
How often does the word leapfrogging enter your mind?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's like M-Pesa in Kenya.
Yeah, and I'll tell you that it's sad because you see also too much attention paid to these terrible examples, like as you and I both saw the slow motion car crash, which was this giant NHS IT project, brought in every vendor under the sun and spent tons of money and yielded nothing.
But because very much, and obviously I wrote a pamphlet all about that called Better for Less in 2010. The whole point around that was built around the system.
Yeah.
And going back to a guy I mentioned earlier, there's a book called Tom Loosemore, who's just brilliant at identifying that you need to build the services around. There's two things. You need to build the services around the user. I used to have on the back of my phone, what does the user need? You've got to build around the user. And the other thing is that the component of delivery is the team. And that's really, really important that you have the teams together and you have small teams can do huge things. One of the other things, brilliant thing about where I work is everything we start is built on the basis of two pizza teams. Mm. You start off with a small team that could be fed by two American pizzas. And if you can't make change happen with that team, it's not going to happen. So you can innovate, spin things up really quickly with small teams to do it, but it's the team that matters.
And those two American pizzas are delivered using that geographic app you built on top of AWS in the case study you gave us in part one.
Yeah, you could say it, I think it could be, yeah.
I don't know. I can eat a whole American pizza, but that's me. And by the way, I lived for a year in Singapore in 2011, going there from the UK with 3 young children. We had a wonderful year there. It could not have been easier because everything worked. All the utilities were paid by barcode at that point, which was a minor miracle. I mean, you could still be able to go to the post office
try
and pay
paying Thames
your
water.
Utility bill in cash in the UK. You might have had to. The medical records, all the citizenship records, all the things that I needed to live my life were immediately digital and available to me in 2011.
Yeah.
And you had a chip pin in your card, in your car, that you stuck in your car. You went into any parking garage and it just charged you. And it told you ahead of time whether or not there was a space free. And you drove in and drove out, you never saw an attendant. It just charged you what the cost was and smart metering and all that. Now,
and just to add to that as well, the only time back to where we are in Britain in 2023, going into the next year's election cycle, what's the only time you ever hold a pencil? It's when you have to vote. It's just weird, isn't it? Yeah. I can't think of any other time in my life where I hold a pencil than when I go into some primary school to commit an act of democracy and vote.
So, Liam, we've got to get you to our final segment of the show, which is our favorite. We ask all of our guests to give us a few of what we call smoke signals, the kind of things that you sniff in the air and you say, well, that spells trouble. And let's just confine it to your area of expertise. When you're sitting down with government ministers and they say to you X, or you're sitting down with your technology partners, because I know AWS works with literally everybody under the sun in the tech world, and they promise this, that, or the other. What are the couple of things that phrases you hear or things that customers ask for where you just go, huh, this is not going to end well.
So I think part of the approach we take is very much about listening to what people want and what people need. And that's really important. And sometimes the way that people express what they want doesn't describe what they actually need. And there is a big difference between the two things there. And that's part of where we can help people with that. I think in industry, why I think you can still find these neologisms, and certainly in government, you find these neologisms that kick in. If I give you an example, when I was in, started in government, the Institute for Government released a report which said, it used the word agile a lot. And everybody
with respect to the British government
and so everyone then decided they were going to go agile and
smoking pretty densely.
And there was Mike Bracken and I went to a particular department, and I remember, and we tossed a coin, and he went on the shop floor and had a look at all the administration. I went in the corporate boardroom, and they were giving me the presentation of how they were going to change their particular department, agency, whatever. And on the board, I went through this huge PowerPoint and that they gave me. And then on the board appeared this word. And he did, Mike just appeared at the door, opened the door to come in. And on the board was the word agilution, because they wanted to go agile, but they wanted to do it at an evolutionary pace. And I just remember this door opening, him looking at it, and then the door shutting. And he just went.
Yes.
And there's the ability to the thing that I notice is the ability to grab hold of those neologisms.
Those buzzwords.
And but being vocally self-critical, we then went and created our own one, which was called Digital by Default. We said lots of other people came back to and said, oh, this is Digital by Default. And because we hadn't been clear enough in describing it, it didn't, you know, other people went off and took it. So the bit where I find challenging in those neologisms is where you can't follow it up with the substance.
Right.
And that, I suppose, without wanting to blow smoke at where I am now and the, you know, I really enjoy working where I work now, because that's so anathema to what
as
we do.
As opposed to analog by actuality, as opposed to digital by default.
Possibly. So it's those, yeah. So it's possibly sort of phrases like that, you know, when you get people talking about blockchain a lot.
Oh.
That's one of those bits. And
our producer's going to edit that word out this podcast, I can tell you now.
Yeah, it's one of those... It's one of those bits where the hype, we all know there's a hype cycle, and I suppose when
McKinsey announced that the metaverse would be worth $5 trillion, which I worked out was the GDP of Japan.
Right. I'm afraid I never saw that. But the ability to, I think that you've got to get back to that ability to actually have a thing that you talk about, as opposed to a bit of vaporware, is still the thing which people trust. And earning trust with people is the most important part of my job. And you just don't get anywhere if you suddenly turn up and go, and in 3 months we're going to do this. It's like, it doesn't happen. It's much easier that you can make all these things work. Go back to the Ukraine example. One of the reasons why we talked about the Ukraine thing inside the company for the first time, and we didn't do it until it was well underway. We did it in the October, and all the change had happened in the year up until June, really. We didn't want to talk about it because it wasn't done.
Right.
And the other component with it was that all of the components that we used were things which had existed for a few years. I mean, snowballs have been around for a while, and we just used existing techniques in a simple way to help someone reach a simple goal. And that was the way of avoiding the bubble.
Yep. I think we're going to wrap up by saying this podcast needs to be more agile, and we'll have to evolve to doing so in our next 200 episodes. But after you listen to this, be sure to tune in next time for our very special guest for our 100th episode, the only man to have ever gone from having CFO of the year to a prison card within 1 year, Andy Fastow, the former CFO of Enron. But I'd like to have a huge thanks to Liam Maxwell, who's had incredible experience at the heart of government and somehow survived with his sanity intact to join the private sector and help other governments at AWS. Thanks very much, Liam, for joining us.
Thank you.
A very special thanks to Oliver Blois and Stella Massonet at Platoon Studios in London. If you're new to Bubble Trouble, we hope you'll follow the show wherever you listen to your podcasts. Bubble Trouble is produced by Eric Nuzum, Jesse Baker, and Julia Natt at Magnificent Noise. You can learn more at bubbletroublepodcast.com. Until next time, for my co-host Will Page, I'm Richard Kramer.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.